Welcome, everybody. This is the first ever podcast at Ground Up Headquarters. The name is Quarantine Coffee Conversation. We're drinking quarantine coffee. We're having conversation. The whole point of this podcast is to keep it short and simple. I'm your host, Alex Theo Harris. I own Ground Up Coffee, and I have a pretty cool network of local entrepreneurs that have built successful businesses in Chicago, and I want to introduce them to you. So we're sponsored by 1104 Productions for the audio equipment, Andreas Andregard and Devin Dismain for the audio and video production. And I have my first guest here, Nick Hansen of Esquire Properties, and he's going to give you insight about the local real estate environment, rehabbing, flipping, renting properties, and all that good stuff. And again, the whole podcast is meant to be short and simple. You learn a lot from my guest, and you're invited to reach out to him after and see how you guys can link up or take a little bit of his information and apply it into your daily lives. So to introduce my guest again, Nick Hansen, welcome. Give us a little, you know, story about yourself. Who are you?
Well, Alex, it's great to be here for your inaugural podcast. I really appreciate being the first one. You know, you can test the waters, and if things don't go right, you can blame me. It's perfectly fine. That's the art of what it takes to be an entrepreneur, right? You learn by failure, and you learn by doing. And that's how I've essentially lived my life, right? So got into real estate at a very young age. Matter of fact, the day I graduated high school, which was in May of 1999, the following day I went to work in the construction trades. And I didn't really have any idea what I was going to do with my life at that point, as many people at that stage in their life encounter, right? So I needed to learn something. I needed to do something. So I started like reading a lot of books on very influential people, billionaires, and I read Forbes magazine, and I saw that the wealthiest people in the world at the time on the billionaire list were people in real estate and financial services. So I kind of like instinctively sort of fell into it, but I learned a lot of things about the construction business, and I kind of started right where the process begins. So I did underground water and sewer. I did demolition. I did excavation. I scrapped metals, you know, copper, aluminum, steel. Sold bricks. I did pretty much anything you could think of to make a buck. I learned trucking. I learned
literal bricks, by the way, right?
We're not talking. Literally brick and mortar, ground up construction. You know, you need to demo the site, you need to excavate the site, and you need to build. And then when you build, you start out with the foundation. You bring the water and sewer to the property. You carpentry.
So you've done it all.
You name it. Yeah. And then I got into real estate as a broker, and I started doing regular retail transactions, and I won a lot of awards, and I received a lot of accolades for my salesmanship as a real estate broker. And then I just kind of like, you know, I wanted more, and I'm a real estate entrepreneur. So I had the hunger inside me to try to learn every single little process, right? Like what's involved with the transaction, right? Getting the contract, securing the financing, but I never really bought, right? So I was doing like third party stuff. I did maybe one transaction, and then I wanted to get into buying and investing full time. And I went into like real estate offices and I said, hey, you know, I want to buy a building, right? I want to buy a two flat. And the real estate brokers were like, that's great, kid. You know, I was probably 18, 19 at the time. And they're like, you know, go to a bank and try to get some financing. And I was like, okay, you know, so I started following the process, the crumbs. And I went into banks and they're like, you know, kids, like, it's not that you have bad credit. It's like, you just don't have any credit at all. And I didn't even have a credit card. So fortunately, I started learning about the credit process. I got a credit card, and I started leveraging other people's services, other people's money. And I was then, fully engrossed in the real estate process.
So let's rewind all the way. What was your first property? Tell us what was that process like and what it was.
So it was a single family home on the south side. I had a friend who was a contractor, and I leveraged my friend and all his guys to help me rehab the house. And then I went to the owner and I said, listen, there's no bank will give me any financing on this deal. I go, can you hold the paper while I rehab it? Which was really risky.
I was about to say, that's unheard of, yeah.
I could have rehabbed the place and the owner could have
told you to leave.
Given me the finger and say thank you. But, you know, my only recourse was, you know, at that time, maybe like punch him in the face, but that would have landed me in jail and I'd have lost all my money. But it was an honest agreement. It was a handshake. And I was very fortunate enough to sell the property for a profit. I paid everybody off. I paid off my credit card that I got. And when I got the credit card, I had like a minimum amount of money that I could tap into. So I called the credit card company and said, hey, can you raise my limit to $10,000? So all the material for the job I put on my credit card, maxed it out, $10,000. And hey, you know, at 19 years old, it's like, whoa, you know, that's a risk, right? So I increased my tolerance for risk at a very early age. And I understood that when you take risk, you have to be willing to like weather the storm, right? You have to have some kind of guts, because if you don't really have the guts to take risk, you'll never really grow as a businessman. You'll never really grow as a person. And what really motivated me was that I was blessed at an early age to come in contact with so many people who basically came here from another country. You know the story.
I know the story. I know you personally, so I know the story.
So people, they came here from another country, didn't have anything, didn't speak the language.
From Greece, right?
Literally, yeah, from Greece, off the boat. You know, honest to goodness, they called them DPs, right? Displaced person. And they were really displaced, but it was the fact that they had 90% guts and 10% brains.
So let's talk about guts, right? Because I know your story from that one single family home on the south side. But now you're a whole different person. You got a whole different portfolio. What do you have now? And what was the risk that you took to get there?
Well, if you want to fast forward 20 years, it was literally trial and error. Mm-hmm. You know, process, elimination, you know, what works, what doesn't work. And there was failure and heartbreak at the beginning. There are many relationships that dissolved because of my aggressive nature and my focus. And it was, it's really, if real estate is not a very complex type of industry. Real estate is an industry where if you buy right in the beginning, you'll make money. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, by the good grace of God, the timing that I got into real estate was exceptional, right? So 20 years ago, you know, 99, 2000, everybody was buying. So I became a regular retail broker and to understand the process. And I was selling homes to first-time home buyers, end users, and all kinds of just regular third-party transaction type businesses. And, you know, then I got into REO servicing.
What is REO?
So REO is an acronym called Real Estate Own. It's when the property... there was an originated loan on the property, and then the loan failed, the bank foreclosed on the property, the bank took it back. Now, in that situation, somebody's got to go out to the property, figure out if it's vacant or occupied. If it's occupied, then they got to deal with the tenants, offer them assistance, or give them the ability to rent back, pay you rent, sign a lease. If they're unruly and they don't cooperate, then you have to try to get them out, because you need to take back the collateral. You need to,
which I'm sure you have many ways of getting people out of there.
Yeah, I've kind of perfected that process, and I've over the you know, through 2000, I believe it was 2005 to about 2010, I was focused primarily on servicing REO properties, distressed type properties where the bank gave a loan, if they foreclosed, people weren't cooperating. It was the subprime meltdown in 2008. And
so that's how you started building your portfolio, right?
Yeah, you know, and there was many. I wore many different hats. So I was a broker. I was a REO asset manager. I was an investor. I was a property manager.
There's so many different moving pieces.
I was buying mortgage notes. So there was many different pieces to my business. Mm-hmm. But I really was like just dead set and focused on real estate throughout my entire career.
How many properties do you own right now?
Well, I don't really like talking about the size of it, but one time at the peak of my career, there was, if you could really think about it this way, when I was an REO asset manager, I was selling nationwide 60 to 70 properties a month myself. And then there were other REO asset managers that I oversaw that were selling, you know, 30 to 40 REOs a month. And we operated in essentially every MSA in America.
What's MSA?
Market service area. So my primary focus, my territory, my region was the Midwest. So I had Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, Ohio, the Rust Belt states. And then occasionally I would do things in Florida. I would do things in Virginia. I'd do things in, you know, the Northeast.
But your territory got hit really hard with the subprime mortgages, right?
Yeah. So fortunately, because I've done so many transactions, and I really couldn't honestly tell you how many transactions I've done over the last 20 years or during that period of time. But I had Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee, Chicago, St. Louis, Des Moines, Iowa, Cincinnati, and those were the areas that were hardest hit by the subprime meltdown. And
can you explain what subprime means?
So subprime is, you know, some sort of low income, if people are hard pressed to get a loan, they can't really get a conventional loan where they're putting 20% down. So they put some sort of, you know, low down payment. They got bad credit. They're challenged. And money at that time was fast and loose. So a lot of people were getting loans that shouldn't have been getting loans. So the fallout was a significant fallout, because the person that couldn't get the loan shouldn't have got the loan, couldn't afford the loan, didn't pay the loan back, and they went into default and they lost their home.
And then you, guys like you, come, they pick up the property, develop it, rehab it if it needs work, and then they put it back on the rental market.
Yeah, and that process there alone involved me with, I focused on evictions, right? The person had to get out, or I had to offer them what's called cash for keys to avoid the eviction process, because you don't want to evict somebody. It disrupts their life. It hurts the market, right? It's costly. You know, some evictions could range up to $20,000. Wow. And you know, evictions, especially in Cook County, could take a very long time. And the timing of you getting that property could disrupt the whole entire deal. The people could be in there, they could be destroying the property, you know, market changes, and your the values get different from the time that you acquired the property versus the time that you can actually do something with the property. So it was interesting. And that was essentially my education. That was my college. So I learned by doing, and I learned by understanding the process, and I did everything from, you know, code violation remediation, grass cuts, snow removal, rekeys, trash outs, board ups, renovate the whole entire property, whether it's just cosmetic improvements to major renovations, you know, tear the property down, rebuild a new property.
So you and your team took a lot of these, you know, what do you call them, like defaults, right?
Yeah, we took a lot of REOs, not only as a third-party REO asset manager, but as a third-party broker and as a real estate investor.
So you guys were huge at one point. So let's throw a blanket number on there. You had over 1,000 properties?
Well, it's probably north of 1,000 across the country as an REO asset manager. And as an investor, maybe, you know, the renovations that I've done are north of, you know, 300 renovations in a 7-8 year window. You know, real estate transactions at one point were like 120 a year to 150 a year. And it wasn't all just me at being the real estate broker. It was I outsourced a lot to a lot of real estate brokers. And that was really the only way to do it because of the volume was so intense, right? And it was a scalable model. So I had to use scalable techniques. And if I was involved in every single transaction, I wouldn't have been able to do it all. So I had to learn how to outsource. I had to learn how to hire within. So I learned the difference between outsourcing a function versus hiring an employee. And to be quite honest with you, the real estate business is generous. The real estate industry and different real estate types of models is very generous in the notion that you can really outsource almost every single function, right? Because everybody knows when they own a business that they got to meet payroll obligations, they got to.
So you found a way to kind of leverage who you had and contract them out to get the work done. So how does a guy like you, who's dealt with so many properties, so many different types of people, done every type of work from rehab to foreclosures, how do you see a property and say, hey, that has value and I can add to it and I can make a profit on it? How do you do that?
Well, I always say this, and I don't want to sound like a broken record. I said it a little bit ago, but you make money in real estate when you buy it. I think that's the most...
Buying right at the right time, right?
Buying right. And,
timing's
always an important factor, right? This is going to be my third market correction, right? And they always say that a correction takes place every 7 to 12 years. So when I first got into the business, 9/11 hit. And that made us rethink the way we secured air travel, right? It was a devastating time, a moment in our country's history. And then 2008 hit, and it was the subprime meltdown, and that made us rethink the way we lended money to people.
And both of those events hit the real estate market really hard, right?
I would like to think that 2008 was more significant than 2001, because it was mostly... But any time in America's history, it's like that it's like a ripple effect, right? I'm not an economist, but over the years I've felt that being in real estate, you're often on the front lines of the economy, and you feel the effects of the economy, and every business person does. So you have to really navigate your business, and you have to have enough financial education to. Understand when everything ebbs and flows, and you have to position yourself accurately when that comes, right? So.
And from what you're saying, you are getting prepared for another.
I think that we were on a good run, and now that this coronavirus hit, and we've all been in quarantine, and the unemployment numbers are almost insane, and it's almost scary. But I believe in this country, and I think this is, we're going to come back bigger and stronger as we've done in the past. And money is still at an all-time low. It's almost insane how low it is. And there's access to capital, there's liquidity. And we will bounce back. And I don't, it's somewhat of a confusing time right now because it's so new. But I think we're going to come back bigger and stronger. And I think that cash is king. And the person that is holding cash and liquidity will be able to take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves. And if the real estate kind of unemployment numbers and employment numbers are like a trigger for me. So if people are not working, they're not buying. It's not because they don't want to buy. So they really can't. They gotta either conserve their money. They gotta watch their bankroll. They gotta survive, right?
So what does that mean? Are you a buyer now because nobody can buy, so you have an advantage, or are you a seller now so that?
Look, I'm always a buyer, right? If it's for the right price, I'll buy anything for the right price, right?
Yeah, because you make money when you buy, right?
You make money when you buy. But what I've learned from 2008 is that cash was king, and I'm definitely trying to get liquid. And I'm definitely trying to raise money because I do think opportunities are going to present themselves in the coming future. Now, this is an election year, and I feel that there's going to be like a little bit of a lull in the action, and the numbers are going to spike. And I think before it gets really better, it might get worse. And maybe this time by next year, because there's a mortgage moratorium, or there's a foreclosure moratorium. There's a freeze. The federal government stepped in. There's a $2 trillion stimulus package that's out there. It takes time for that stuff to hit. And it will get better. It will get worse. And there'll be like a little bit of a troubled time. And everybody will be confused. But it's all about consumer confidence. And once consumer confidence is regained and restored, then I think the sky's the limit. And again, sorry to sound like a broken record, but we're going to come back bigger and stronger.
Nice. So that's cool from a perspective of a real estate entrepreneur, right? Let's talk about Joe Schmo. Maybe he has a steady job or is, you know, looking for a new route to gain revenue and a stream of income. Is right now a good time for a Joe Schmo to buy a two flat and earn income property on that?
Or income, I think income so. Rents on that? Yes, absolutely. Because it's someone that's buying a regular retail transaction is normally going to live in it for a longer period of time than as opposed to an investor.
Yeah.
So like me, there's a lot of turmoil. If I buy a property, if I'm really going to make money, I maybe want to hold it for a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to buy it as a regular retail broker, as a regular retail buyer, and you want to live in it, yeah.
It's a good time.
I think it's a good time. You know, you can get probably 2-3% mortgage rates. When have you ever in the history of, money's cheap, so someone needs to take advantage of it.
So then are you positioning yourself? So are you like selling off some of your?
I am. I've created two semi-large real estate portfolios, and I've been selling one portfolio off, and I have about 10 or 12 properties left in that portfolio. And I've really focused on the residential space. So a lot of people, they think, well, are you in commercial? Are you in residential? Are you in industrial? What do you do? So me, I'm in the 1-4 family types of assets, but I also own 14 units, 12 units. But the moat, as you can call it, you know, the moat to get in the castle, and the most promising thing for me over the last couple of years is being based in Chicago. And some of the national guys have really leaned on me for advice, and they've really leaned on me for support. And I see things on a national level, right?
But you got a local market because you've been on the street.
I've specialized in Chicago. I specialize in Cook County. I understand the eviction process. I know how to speed up the eviction process. You know, for me, it's 60 to 90 days. I can get a forcible entry on an uncontested court call, 90 to 120 days on a contested court call. I have very good attorneys. I've really worked out the process.
I don't know what any of that means, but it sounds like you're really good at what you do.
But if you look at Chicago on a national level, the moat, the barrier of entry to buy these properties is low. So if you're an investor and you look at a property and say, I'd say $150,000, $200,000 property, and you lose, okay, yeah, it's a big hit, right? But go to like markets like Los Angeles, you know, $800,000 for a house, and you put, you try to sell it for $1,200 to $1,300 a square foot, you value add. It's you pony up $800,000 to $1.2 million in capital, and you're waiting 12 to 15 months to try and sell that property. And if you lose, that $1 million is a big hit. But if you come to Chicago, your moat, as Warren Buffett always uses, your barrier of entry, you know, moat, AKA barrier of entry, is low. 150 to 200,000, you maybe sell it for, you know, rough calculations, 300 to 400,000, right?
So it sounds like you're saying like margins are bigger here and you're able to take advantage.
And you also have cash flow on some of these properties. Now, will that change with property taxes on the rise? Yeah, of course. But values will fall. Just because the numbers and the calculations of the properties will be...
Is that how it works? Taxes go up, prices go down?
Yes and no. But, you know, I think this is a very good market. The bureaucracy of the government is very tough, but you can navigate around that.
Cool. So you've got an extensive portfolio, but you're selling off pieces of it because you want more opportunity for what you do well.
Yeah, I've tried the bulk sale, package it together, and there's always that opportunity.
Yeah.
And there's definitely that option, but one-off type transactions in that space is so a guy like you wants to buy a house, you can come to me and I can sell you a house and give you a good deal on it.
Very cool. Or if, you know, somebody like Joe Schmo that I use for an example is looking for another stream of revenue because they're uncertain in this time with like all the coronavirus and quarantine that we're all undergoing, you know, they can reach out to you, find a decent two flat, live in one, rent the other, kind of have a sense of security, right?
I think the two flat is the best commodity that someone could ever purchase as a retail buyer. And the world has changed and the way we live has changed. And you see it more so since 2008, right? Before we didn't have, you know, the mobile workforce type environment, right? And you didn't have Grubhubs, you didn't have Uber, you didn't have all those Lyft, you didn't have that stuff. And, you know, remote jobs, go to work, you know, get a lunch pail and go to work. Where have you really, that stuff's sort of going away. So, you know, the mobile workforce type living, the mobile workforce is, so if you have a two flat, you get great, a great loan, you get to take advantage of the income.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to do it.
Sounds good, because then that way, like how you said, I know we've talked and you said that managing a property can be tedious sometimes. You know, if you're living in one unit and you're working from home, right, you can oversee the property.
Plus, there's also a lot of loans available for first-time home buyers. You know, there's FHA products out there with 3% down. Then there's a lot of lenders out there that you know, cater to that type of space.
That's interesting. That's really cool. 3% on a two flat, so you can buy yourself a stream of revenue pretty cheap, right?
Yeah, and you know, and then you can, over a period of 10 years, your investment strategy could be buy 10 of those in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years. And then when those things are paid off in 30 years, mm-hmm. you can take advantage of the income stream as a retirement.
Mm, nice.
You know, if you don't have a pension, if you don't have investments
yeah.
to pay you out.
That can be your investment.
Yeah, because eventually, by the good grace of God, you'll pay those loans off and those things will be owned free and clear and you'll have value, you'll have cash flow.
Yeah, and that's more for the everyday person. So what's your timeline look like? So if somebody buys a property and they want to see it as a solid investment as their retirement fund for 30 years or so, you know, what's that contrary to how Nick is going about things? Because you're a buyer and seller, you're a mover and shaker. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, it's a little bit different for me. Although, you know, now I'm sort of settling down a little bit with regards to taking massive amounts of risk. But I do like flips, you know, get in, get out, rehab, get out. It's definitely not as good as owning it for long periods of time in terms of paying capital gains taxes, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a very versatile real estate investor. I buy and sell anything and I broker. And right now I'm just basically living in the now. And I just, you know, whatever comes my way, I'll take advantage of it.
Very cool. Very cool. So your timeline is a little bit different than the average person.
I would say that, yeah.
But the average person can learn a lot from you. So, you know, what's your website? Where can people reach out to you if they found this interesting? How can they, you know, get a piece of your knowledge or maybe one of your properties to start investing?
So they can find me at esqnow.com. And there's, you know, you can find me on many different forums. If you can't find me now, chances are I probably don't want to talk to you. But I welcome anyone, and I'm willing to give advice to anyone that's interested in becoming a real estate investor or just even buying a home. I'm a real estate broker. I'm a broker with App Properties. And I'm full cradle to grave focused on residential real estate.
So you've had some crazy experiences in real estate. What is a skill set that you think you have to have or that you have in real estate to be successful?
Well, if you want to really get down to the nitty gritty and the technical aspects, I mean, you have to know the game, right? You have to know values. You have to know the transaction process. You have to know certain legal strategies. But it's really all about mindset. And it's all about risk tolerance. Because if you're not able to take on risk, and you know, I don't know what the viewers out there, what you're accustomed to doing and taking risk. I mean, you're a business owner, so you understand risk. Mm-hmm. And you're putting everything out there. And, you know, a lot of times in real estate, you know, when you, you know, you raise capital, it's to the tune of millions of dollars, or you have an asset and you're trying to make a return on the investment, there's many sleepless nights, right? When things can go wrong. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. You got to know how to handle insurance because places burn down uninspectedly, and you got to understand construction, and you really have to be a doctor to some degree with respect to how to rebuild a house, how to renovate a house. Because if you look at a toxic asset, a distressed piece of property, it's sitting there, it's got gangbangers in there, it's got drug dealers in there, it's got prostitutes in there. It's being used as a stash house. The whole block is, and the corner is just lit up, and there's open air drug markets. It's about EQ and IQ. And a lot of people, they go to school, they get this great IQ. You go to Harvard University, you get like you're so intelligent, right? You're so book smart. But you don't understand when someone's lying to you, and you don't understand how to talk to somebody in a way to get them off the block, right? You don't understand how to get somebody out of house that's got a gun or buddies behind you ready to shoot you if you come in, because you're screwing up their business. And there's been many times in the past where, there's been properties that I've had to go and repo and take over, or that I bought that either have been boarded up or had some sort of element in there. You know, most real estate brokers or most real estate people, they can't deal with that sort of thing. And if you're operating in the city of Chicago, you know, you have a lot of different economic and street type elements working against you, right? And, you know, Chicago right now is, you know, you got them. And if you look at it from a national level, there's very high crime. There's a lot of murders. There's a lot of shootings.
So you particularly deal, you know, in places where most people wouldn't necessarily deal. So you got to have a wide skill set to deal with this type of scenario, right?
Yeah, low socioeconomically challenged communities throughout the Chicagoland area has been the majority of my career. And back to my original point, you got to kind of be a doctor. So if you got a house that's vacant, right? You got code violations on that house. You got to really rebuild it. You got to kill the cancer. You got to just really restore it and make that a productive investment. You have to really restore it and take away the urban blight, right? Because, you know, God forbid a woman gets raped in there, you know, walking down the street. The kids are, you know, buying and selling drugs, needles,
there's an element of surprise every time you buy a property.
Every time.
Yeah.
And you you got to know what gang is in what area. And there's, you know, the values in Chicago vary by block to block, right? So if you're west of a certain street, that value can be $100,000 to $200,000 difference as opposed to something that's east of that street. And you have to know that, because if you're doing a market analysis in a mile radius of the city of Chicago, that could really hurt you, right? You could think you're getting like $300,000 when you're only going to get really $150,000 for a fixed up product. Rough scenario.
So you've dealt with everything. You've dealt with like high income places, low income, but most of it's been low income.
And I like the lower income stuff and the medium income stuff. You know, and I like dealing with people.
Is it because the margins are greater? Is that why?
It's how many, if you take a pyramid, right, and you go to the top, there's only so many people at the top of the pyramid, and only so many people can afford that type of product, and it's limited. But if you take the pyramid and you flip it upside down, there's more people at the bottom of the pyramid that can afford that type of product. And I'd like to sell more product to more people as opposed to selling one product to one person.
Ah, I see.
Right? Because if, you know, I might sell $1.2 million house, I might make a good rip, but if I sell 40 houses for $1 million, you know, it's the same thing, but it's better for me. Yeah, so I had a property once in Little Village. And I went in there, you could tell it's like graffiti. They tagged the house all over the place, graffiti, everything. So I go in there, and luckily there was nobody in the property. So and I was taking my pictures, I was inspecting it, and then I started hearing this scratching in the bathtub, and I'm like, what the heck could that be? So I started getting closer, and the scratching started getting louder and louder. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, so I slid the glass to the bathtub open. There was like a 4.5-foot alligator in the bathtub.
What?
Yeah, it was a 4.5-foot alligator in the bathtub. So I went in there, I took my picture.
There's an alligator in Little Village in a bathtub.
In a bathtub in an abandoned house that clearly was overtaken by some criminal element.
When was this?
10, 15 years ago.
That's awesome.
So
we had some sort of like Joe Exotic situation there.
Yeah. So I
Tiger King, right?
You know, so I called the animal control. Yeah. And I locked the door behind me. I called animal control and I took off. Right. And I had to go do my other run. There's more properties on the list that day. And then animal control calls me. They're like, yeah, hey, we're here. You know, they came almost instantaneously. Right. And we got an alligator in the bathtub. So almost instantaneously, they came and...
So like, actually, it's a crocodile.
Yeah, they told me, they're like, hey, it's not here. I'm like, what do you mean it's not there? They're like, yeah, man, there's nothing here. So later on in the day, I think it was maybe the next day, there was this all over the news that there was an alligator that was swimming on the North Branch of the Chicago River, and there were helicopters, and there were all kinds of... There are all kinds of media outlets there. To some degree, I live my life like a cartoon, as I told you.
Yeah. And, I don't know what that means. Can you elaborate on that?
I don't know either. It's just that I think I've been very blessed to be given this life that I have, and I try to make the best of it because.
Oh, the life that you've been shot at, stabbed, hit with a baseball bat. You're blessed.
Yeah.
You're cool with that?
Yeah. You know, every time that's happened, I got tougher, stronger. I learned a lot more.
I like that mentality.
You know, when you fail, you learn what not to do. When you get beat up, you know, you figure out how to survive. And
can people watch you get beat up on your Instagram?
You would like that, wouldn't you?
I like that.
There's something wrong with you.
I hear that you do a charity boxing event where you do get beat up, though.
So last year I fought in the Real Estate Rumble.
Cool.
And we filled the Park West Theater.
Mm-hmm.
We raised a lot of money for Big Brothers and Big Sisters charitable organization here in Chicago.
Very cool. Did you win or lose?
No, I was winning the fight for 3 straight rounds, and I got dropped the 3rd round, and they wouldn't let me continue, but I was willing and able to continue. But because it's an exhibition bout, and the guy was, you know, 20, 30 pounds heavier than me, he was the Golden Glove champion of Arizona, and I think he was either 12-1 or 14-1. He's my friend now. We become really good friends, actually.
After you fight?
Yeah, after the fight.
Oh, okay.
He hit hard, but I'd like
usually
to say...
I'm friends with people before we fight, and then the fight ruins it, but yours is the opposite.
Yeah, I'm different. Yeah. I don't know. You can do a lot of things to me, and chances are I'll take it, and I'll probably be your friend.
So if you want to be Nick's friend, you have to fight him. No.
Well, there's got to be some kind of... There's got to be... You got to, like, have a tooth chipped.
From you to fight you, right?
Well, yeah, I know. Maybe I'm different. You know, sometimes you got to, like, have a... You gotta have maybe getting punched in the face, have a tooth chipped to have me respect you, because you know it's a lot difficult if you don't understand the world in which I live in.
You are a cartoon, one of the most hard-nosed guys, but also the biggest heart. Has a successful real estate business, does charitable work with the money that he makes and you know his network makes, and a really knowledgeable guy. So reach out to him. Via Instagram at Mr_Cadillac with a K, or at his website Esquire.
ESQNow.com.
ESQNow.com. Esquire Properties, right?
Yeah. Esquire Properties is my company. If you're interested in selling your home, I'd be willing to make an offer. You can avoid commissions and certain fees, or if you're interested in selling your home, you don't want to sell it to me, you don't like the price I give you, I'm more than happy to listed on the public domains.
Yeah. Or if somebody's looking to acquire one of your properties for rental, they could always reach out to you. Or just
yeah, that's my focus now. I'm in liquidation mode, and I have three very successful portfolios that I'd be happy to give you at a good price. Turnkey real estate investments, cash flowing properties.
Wonderful. So reach out to him any of those ways. And I want to thank you guys for tuning into the first podcast. You could follow my company, Ground Up Shy, to see all of our, you know, cafe stuff. You can follow me personally at SwoleCrates on Instagram. And stay tuned for the next episode. Thanks, guys.